This is FSN.
Ah, thanks very much, Simon. Welcome to Monday's programme. The sun is shining. It's got its hat on here in the northwest of the UK. Lovely afternoon it is. July 20th, 2020. Welcome to the first Richie Allen radio show of the week.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen radio show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
Are you all excited about the vaccine, are you? Are you? Oh yeah, I can't wait.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Well, the investigative journalist and politician Zed Phoenix returns to the Richie Allen radio show in hour two. He wants to take the government to court, does Zed. We'll talk about that. We've obviously gotten into court cases against the government with Simon Dolan and others recently. But Zed wants to take them to court. There's a big campaign going on to raise funds to do just that. We'll talk to him in hour two. He's done some terrific work linking the SAGE committee group members with Bill Gates and beyond. Much more besides that as well. Before that, though, the Irish broadcaster, columnist, author, the great Kevin Myers returns to the programme. He wrote a terrific piece in The Spectator last week. Great to see Kevin Myers back writing. And it was about, well, it wasn't just about J.K. Rowling, but a little bit was. It's about cancel culture. We'll talk to Kevin Myers this hour. Monday's programme brought to you in association with nobody. It's just yours truly. Thanks for putting up with my absence yesterday afternoon. Yesterday morning, I was in a bad way. And I didn't really recover until I got out of bed this morning. I wasn't great now. Wasn't a sight for sore eyes, as I am usually not either, it must be said. Anyway, let's get into, obviously, the big developing story this afternoon is the news that Oxford University is pretty pleased with the progress it has made in developing a vaccine against that dreadful disease and epidemic that is COVID. And we were all waiting for it. Are you like this now at the moment, are you? No? Give me a woo-hoo. No? No. Okay. Here's how the story broke at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Oh, yeah.
This is Sky News Today, 3 o'clock. These are our headlines. Our COVID-19 vaccine is safe and induces an immune reaction. Breaking news this afternoon from the University of Oxford.
Yeah, there you go. Our Oxford University says our vaccine is safe and they said it induces an immune response.
Surprise, surprise.
Oh, yeah. Go on, Stella.
The unexpected hits you between the eyes. The unpredictable.
That's the surprise you see.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Well, they were never going to come out and say, listen, lads, we gave it a good go for about 4 months there, but we're getting nowhere. Where are they? You know, that would have been lovely, wouldn't it, today? Oxford University have just given up. They've closed the doors to their laboratories and they've pissed off down the pub, face mask in tow. Let's hear more about it then. Let's hear the real story.
Hi there, good afternoon. Trials at Oxford University and their coronavirus vaccine have shown it induces a strong immune response in healthy adults. The trial currently leading to the race to find an effective jab also appeared safe with few side effects. Let's turn straight to Professor Andrew Pollard, the group lead of the Oxford vaccine.
Yeah, the main man now, Andrew Pollard, the main man.
Group that's developing the vaccination. And Professor, I know you're in a rush, so I'm rushing to get to you. Give us a broad summary of what we've found in this trial.
What we found in this trial is, first of all, that the vaccine has a profile which is very, very similar to other types of vaccines like this. It's well tolerated by the volunteers who took part in the study. And secondly, that we've met a really important milestone, which is showing that we've got strong immune responses, which we think are the sort that may be associated with protection. But of course,
maybe.
But of course, we've got to keep going with the clinical trials to really establish whether or not we can prevent the disease in our population with these strong immune responses.
Any evidence of side effects?
Well, like with other vaccines of this type, that some people feel a bit fluey after vaccination and have a sore arm, but there were no significant concerning side effects.
Yeah, they said the same thing after swine flu was made available. Yeah, some of the volunteers complained of they didn't sleep well for a couple of days, and one bloke had a headache. Yeah, and another bloke had a bit of a rash. But then some of those blokes later on got narcolepsy, you see. So I wouldn't get too excited now about the claim that the side effects are minimal. Not just yet.
Yeah, when you talk about the volunteers, how many involved in this?
Of course, he could have said that, the interviewer Colin Brazier, but he ain't me, is he?
Well, we had 1,077 people in this initial trial, but we've now moved on from these first trials and have almost 10,000 people now around the world who are in the later phase trials, where we're trying to establish whether or not the vaccine protects against COVID-19.
Does this vaccine protect? Because they still don't know this, of course. And when he says we have volunteers around the world, he means in Africa and he means in South America, in Brazil. Places where governments are, well, very sympathetic to people sticking pus and shit into their citizens, with guarantees that if those citizens later on become ill, don't worry about it now, Glaxo or AstraZeneca, you won't be sued. You've passed enough brown envelopes around our country. That's what's going on here. Okay, okay. So they don't know if the vaccine will protect you out in the wider population. Not yet. It's difficult, says Andrew Pollard. Sure, it is difficult.
But now we have to wait to see whether people in the trial are protected. And that is going to take some time because we have to wait for disease cases to occur in our population of people who are vaccinated in order to see whether we've got protection or not. And so it is difficult to predict exactly when we'll have that readout from the vaccine. So I think it's not necessarily caution to say it may take a while. We just don't know the future. If the lockdown here in the UK has been so successful that we...
Wait till you hear this tidal wave of bull spit now. What he's actually saying here in a, I don't know, I suppose in an obfuscating way. Yes, an obfuscating way. He's about to tell you there's hardly any virus around in the UK. Therefore, it's difficult for us to measure the success of the vaccine. He actually says that in an obfuscating way.
So successful that we've... The lockdown here in the UK has been so successful... Yeah. That we managed to, thankfully, suppress the virus considerably. But it hasn't gone away. And so in time, we are going to get an answer to whether or not this vaccine works.
Yeah, yeah. Lockdown suppressed it, he said. Suppressed the virus so there ain't so many cases around. So it's difficult. He's lying. He's lying. The evidence is emerging around the world and in the UK that despite the media's best efforts to bury it, herd immunity has already happened. Naturally. As it always does, because without boring the absolute piss out of you by telling you what you already know, we know that this particular virus is really only serious for people that are over 65 and who have underlying medical problems, which means they are immunosuppressed. It's not a big deal to anybody else at all. Most of us have probably had it now without symptoms and it's gone. So he's lying. They have to lie, you see. That's what they do, they lie. He has to lie to sell this. Oh, the reason we can't get people infected at the moment, and we'd love to get people infected, it's because we did so well at suppressing the virus in the lockdown. No, it's because most of us have had it, you dipstick, Rodney. So the presenters are delighted. Radio presenters, delighted. Thrilled, acting like school children. Nobody asking any real questions whatsoever, you know. In fact, Colin Brazier, you can check this out if you don't believe me, went on to praise him, Pollard and his team, saying, you're under so much pressure. Oh, well done, you know. God love you. You should hear them. No questions whatsoever. Mad. In the Daily Mail today, Paul Hunter, Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia, said, and I quote, if we get an effective vaccine and almost everyone takes it up, overnight all the restrictions can stop and life will return to normal like it was before March with no social distancing or restrictions. Way to tell the truth, Paul. Blackmail. I'm going to use the Daily Mail to blackmail the nation, or at least those who read the Daily Mail. If you do what we say, roll your sleeve up and take the toxic tidal wave of shit that we inject into you, well, then you can go back to the football stadiums and everything else. Why did Paul Hunter say that? Well, he said that because he was responding to surveys which suggested that 27% of people in the UK won't have the jab, including yours truly. God love me. And today, mandatory was the buzzword. Shall we drop in on Jeremy Vine, BBC Radio 2? Mandatory was the buzzword. Julian Savulescu, Oxford again. Oxford again. He's a professor looking at the ethics of new technologies. So he looks at new technologies and he evaluates their ethical practicalities, their ethical properties. Is it good enough? Is it moral enough to be out there in the public? Jeremy Vine, BBC Radio 2, asks this guy, Julian Savulescu, Oxford. He says, should this thing be mandatory?
There's a strong argument for it, yes, if it's safe enough, and that's a big if. We've never produced a vaccine against a coronavirus, so I think one thing we would have to do is have a long, hard look at the safety data. But if it's safe enough, then it's just like putting on a seatbelt in a car. Interestingly, 50% of Americans also resisted the introduction of mandatory seatbelt laws, and now 70% of them accept it.
Yeah, and of course, Vine is so utterly useless, like every other presenter in the mainstream, that he doesn't stop him and say, listen, arsewipe, wearing a seatbelt isn't an invasive technology. Can you not get that through your thick head? Putting a seatbelt on might have felt a bit uncomfortable for drivers, but it wasn't invasive. We're talking about putting chemicals into people's bodies. That's different, son. But of course, Vine sits there and says nada. Niente.
You put a seatbelt on to protect yourself in the car.
Why are the Aussies so thick, eh? Except the ones who listen to this programme, it must be said.
Reduces injuries and death by 50%, but also to protect other occupants in the car.
Yeah, it's all about protecting other people.
And also to reduce the use of limited health resources. Now, seatbelts, you know, are clearly safe and now they're accepted, even though people were opposed to compulsory seatbelts.
Jesus, why doesn't Vine jump in? This is rubbish presenting, isn't it?
Seatbelts initially. And you know, sometimes they even kill people. They even cause seatbelt syndrome, injuries. But the benefits vastly outweigh the risk.
This guy could go on for hours. He's a genius, this guy. Bit of filibuster. Oh, God.
Risks. And, you know, when that risk-benefit profile is sufficient, you know, we should make it mandatory.
We should make it mandatory, says yet another guy associated with Bill Gates. Or people who are directly associated with Bill Gates. The fix is in. The fix is in. What about religious exemptions then?
Well, we don't take, you know, religious objections to seatbelts.
This guy is comedy gold, isn't he? Everything is seatbelts, eh?
We do allow
We take them to crash helmets on motorbikes sometimes.
Well, maybe we shouldn't. It depends on the extent. Of course, if you can achieve herd immunity quickly enough by allowing some exceptions, then you may not need to make it mandatory for everyone. But in general, for example, in Australia, they've introduced mandatory vaccination, the so-called no jab, no pay policy, where you don't get child benefits if your child's not vaccinated. You don't get financial benefits, and there aren't religious exceptions.
So there's a sanction rather than, it's not mandatory, but if you lose money if you're not injected. And similarly, I know in New York State, they actually said that they would stop teenagers who couldn't prove that they'd been immunised from walking around in public.
Yeah, there are various ways of making it mandatory. One is to withhold benefits like childcare or the ability to go to school. So some US states don't allow you to go to school unless you've got a vaccination certificate. Or Italy fines people who don't have their children vaccinated. And that's led to a rapid increase in vaccination. But I stress that's in vaccines where we know we've got good evidence that they're safe enough. I think what we do need to be sure before we introduce a mandatory policy that we're dealing with something which is safe enough.
Right, but
this is going somewhere now. That's quite funny, actually. This guy is Julian. How do I pronounce this bloody name again? I don't want to get it wrong. He's actually a philosophy professor, this guy. He isn't Julian Savulescu. He isn't a doctor. He certainly isn't an epidemiologist or a virologist. He's a guy who's a philosopher who looks at ethics around new technologies. And Vine is rubbish. Vine was helping him along there. Yeah, in New York, you can't go out. It's Vine's job, on behalf of the people who listen to his programme, to suggest to this guy from Oxford. A lot of people would say that's totalitarianism. A lot of people would say you're going down a very dark road by telling them that they must have something stuck in their arms. That's his job and it's very basic. But he doesn't, Vine. No, he helps them along. But this does go somewhere quite funny. So this guy has compared seatbelts to vaccines to seatbelts. He's waffled on about punishing people by withdrawing their benefits and child support and all that sort of stuff. And where it goes next is, well, it's quite funny.
Safe enough.
Right. But that's the issue, isn't it? And you're a professor of practical ethics. So if somebody in all conscience, and they're not mucking around, says, I'm not taking a vaccine in the first 2 years of its use under any circumstances, you would still fine them?
Well, look, to be honest with you, I've got antibodies, so, you know.
What?
I presumably don't need the vaccine.
What, antibodies to what? To corona?
To COVID-19, yeah, to COVID.
Oh, I've got antibodies, mate. You flaming galah. I don't have to have the vaccine, mate. This is quality. I don't have to have it because I have the antibodies, but everybody else should have it.
COVID-19.
But how do you know that you've had a test?
Yeah, and...
There's a research...
That didn't sound very honest, did it? Vine says, how do you know that? Have you had a test? Yeah.
You know, I presumably don't need the vaccine.
What, antibodies to what? To corona?
To COVID-19. Yeah, to COVID-19.
But how do you know that you've had a test?
Yeah, and...
There's a research the last week or so which says that they may fade after 3 months.
Well, then that's going to be a problem for the vaccine if it's relying on antibodies as well. So, you know, so I wouldn't be myself hugely inclined to have it, but I would have
right.
it if it was made, but I would have it if it was made mandatory.
And Vine laughs at him.
What kind of fuckery
he laughs. This guy is demanding that everybody gets the vaccine once it's proven to be safe. Everybody has to have it. Are you having it? No. Why? I have antibodies. Why? Because you did a test? Yeah. Jeremy Vine this afternoon. It's everywhere. Here's Gordon Dugan, Cambridge University. They're involved as well, speaking with Adam Bolton. You'll hear Adam Bolton first, the presenter. Then you'll hear Gordon Dugan, Professor of Medicine at Cambridge University.
Some people are saying, well, we're just going to have to get used to it. COVID's going to come back year after year, season after season. Are you with them or are you a bit more optimistic?
I'm optimistic in the sense that, you know, I've worked on epidemic diseases in many parts of the world, and what will happen is people will have to learn to live psychologically with this threat. We are seeing that by managing ourselves better, that we can reduce the incidence of the disease, but also if we now get better vaccines and we get better treatments of the disease, that it will be less of a threat to those who are vulnerable to it.
Yeah. You heard that bit in the middle, didn't you?
What will happen is people will have to learn to live psychologically with this threat.
We're just going to have to learn, God damn it, to live psychologically with the threat until such time as we're told here's the vaccine, which the UK government has ordered, as you heard in the news. They've ordered vaccines to date nearly 100,000. Let me say that again. Nearly 100 million doses. They've been saying today as well that some people might need to have more than one dose. Yeah, this is where we are. And finally for now, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to subject you. I was going to play a little bit more James O'Brien from LBC. I'm not going to put that to you. I'm not going to do it to you because it's a Monday and you don't need it on a Monday. Welcome to your Richie Allen radio show live from Salford in the greater part of Manchester on a glorious afternoon. It's been absolutely lovely. Lovely day yesterday as well. Although I didn't see very much of it. I was convalescing, self-inflicted wounds and all of that. Here is music from Len. We haven't had much of a summer thus far. We had a bit of a spring, all right, not much of a summer. Here's Len then. When we come back from Len, Kevin Myers, the Irish journalist and broadcaster, will be on the programme. And you don't want to miss him. He's a top guy. Zed Phoenix a bit later on as well. Packed old show on Monday. Packed a week of shows for you. Your Richie Allen Show, the BBG. Music from Len, Steal My Sunshine. That's pretty apt. This Monday, July 20th, 2020. On the Richie Allen Show, live in Salford. Right, let's get into it then. My guest this hour is an author, a broadcaster, and a legendary newspaper columnist. Now, you will know that back in 2017, he was thrown under a bus by his publisher and his fellow journalists after writing a typically sharp observational piece about the BBC gender pay gap. In the piece was a line about Claudia Winkleman and Vanessa Feltz doing well for themselves. Good for them, wrote my guest, adding, Jews are not generally noted for their insistence on selling their talent for the lowest possible price. Now, every Jew I know, my accountant here in Manchester, his boss, a rabbi who comes on this programme every now and then, said, Myers is right. It's quite funny, nothing in that. But he was gone. He was out, and we talked to him about it at the time. Very distressing time for him and for his family. One of his most gleeful critics at the time was the author J.K. Rowling. Oh, the irony. And he's written a brilliant article in The Spectator. It was in The Spectator late last week about it. Let's welcome back to the programme our friend Kevin Myers. Kevin, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, thank you very much. Much buoyed by the response to my piece in The Spectator. And I was very grateful that The Spectator has defended me almost uniquely in the publishing world of Ireland and Britain. Sunday Independent has also been, of Dublin, has been a stout friend. Otherwise, just about every journalist in Britain and Ireland has either stayed silent watching my professional destruction or has eagerly joined in the fray, the kicking party. And these are people who found that they had nothing seriously against me before. They never accused me of anti-Semitism, and they never accused me of the other vice, misogyny, in the entire reach of the 20th century. Yet 3 years ago, next week is the anniversary, 3 years ago they all piled in with these false allegations of misogyny and anti-Semitism. So it was a dark period in my life, but it was also an illuminating period because I found the meaning of friendship and the meaning of loyalty. But I tell you one thing, in circumstances like that and in times like those, the numbers of friendship or friends you actually have is about half what you think.
I can
and
imagine.
That's not the kind of discovery you ever want to make, and you don't know which ones are which.
No, I can imagine you don't. Well, thanks for speaking candidly about how you felt back then. I mean, it was a very interesting conversation we had at that time when you were very emotional, but also you were very succinct in describing what was going on and what was happening. Just for our listeners who might not know, Kevin wrote many articles about the Holocaust over the years, and as he said himself, and you know, he has been a supporter of the State of Israel for years. Thanks for being candid about that. You mentioned the Sunday Independent. Niamh Horan, I think, is the writer. Very good piece this weekend. I like to think you're a bit like... I like to think you're decent and you're genuine. So when J.K. Rowling was getting hammered from all quarters for her, again, fairly benign opinion on a controversial issue... you would be forgiven if you were to say, as we would say when we were 5 years old, na 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 na, how do you like it, love? But not at all, Kevin. You don't take that tone in your piece in The Spectator.
No, there's no point. We are a civilizational crossroads. I believe this very sincerely, that we are heading down the path towards a cultural dictatorship. And we don't know the outcome of this. But while people silence voices they dislike, and while people do not defend the voices that they dislike, you know, as I dislike J.K. Rowling's voice when she attacked me, I have to defend her right to express her opinion on this transgender issue. Now, I did in that piece take issue with the medium through which she expressed herself, Twitter, with 140 words.
Yeah.
It's just stupid. It's just futile. I said it was a reinvented form of telegraphy.
That's right.
You cannot deal with an issue as complex anatomically and emotionally and psychologically as transgenderism in just a few words. And don't even try. It's for those people thus affected, it is an issue of enormous heartbreak and anguish and pain. And it has to be treated with the utmost respect and sensitivity. And the sort of brevity of language compelled by its users, on its users by Twitter, means that you cannot nuance what you want to say and you cannot featherbed your words in a way that will protect the victims of this condition. So it's one of those things that the medium is not amenable to emotional sensitivity, and nor is it amenable to precision. But nonetheless, she should be allowed to express herself, and most of all, as this is true for you, Richard, as it is for all of your listeners, we should be allowed to be wrong. We should be allowed to make a mistake. We should be allowed to be in error without the roof falling in on us irrevocably, as happened to me. I mean, what's happened to me is, and it will remain, that I am never going to be a newspaper columnist again. That is an absolute certain fact. That can never happen, because every single newspaper in Ireland and Britain lied about me. And I couldn't work for any of them, because that would make me complicit in the lies that were told against me. But the most important thing is not personal. The most important thing is that we have to defend the right of people to express unpopular opinions and to not be destroyed.
Do you think it's a generational thing, Kevin?
Vigorously took part in my destruction 3 years ago. Yeah. And it's not because I like her, although I admire her greatly as a novelist, and she's done wonderful things for civilization, because she got young boys to read books again. There was a whole generation of young boys who'd stopped reading books, and she reversed that process. And she, you know, we need people like her, but we do not need people like her silencing voices they dislike.
Is it a generational thing? I mentioned to you last time out, we won't get into it, maybe in the future, I wouldn't be a supporter of the State of Israel. And I think it's a generational thing, because some of my biggest backers in terms of, you know, providing me with facilities to make television programmes and radio programmes are Jewish friends in Manchester who do support the State of Israel. But they, because they're older, they would say, well, it doesn't define you, Richie. And we obviously know that you don't have any issue with Jewish people. But on Twitter, I couldn't say stuff about, and I'd want to get into, I'm just using this as an example, I don't want to get into Israel today. I couldn't get into it there, because I'd be lambasted from all sides. But I think there's a generational thing going on here. I think if you're above a certain age, you can coexist with people and take them as the sum of their parts. Lionel Shriver wrote a piece about you last year, and it was fantastic. You know, you mentioned it a second ago, the right to be wrong, the right to have an opinion that isn't backed up by any evidence and to just be dismissed. Oh, yeah, well, look, he's got it wrong. I think it might be generational, and I worry about 20-somethings, 30-somethings not being robust enough to go through life and have their ideas and their absolutes challenged. Is it generational?
Well, you're absolutely right to worry. Jonathan Haidt, the social psychologist of New York University, noticed in around the year 2013, 2014, that incoming undergraduates to the universities of America, and it wasn't just New York City University, other universities, because you're getting feedback from academics elsewhere, were just insisting for the first time that they be protected from hearing opinions they didn't like.
Yeah.
And they insisted on getting this new thing called the safe space. Now, when I was at university a very long time ago, what we cherished most of all was lack of safety. What we wanted was danger. What we wanted was unorthodoxy. What we wanted was to challenge the conventions. This generation of students wanted to reinforce the conventions. They wanted a wall built around them so they wouldn't hear things that they didn't like or things that made them feel uncomfortable. And Jonathan Haidt has linked this with the emergence of social media. Just at these kids were around seven, they began to discover, or social media began to discover the world, and the world began to discover social media. And the outcome of that was that these people were turned into a condition of permanent fragility, from which it has proved almost impossible to rescue them. Now, those people born in, say, 1996-ish, they're the 24-year-olds leading the riots, the Black Lives Matter riots in America, and probably in Britain too, and their young subalterns will be 18 and 19. This is the woke generation, or they call themselves woke, but they're not. They're sleepwalking. They're not woke at all. They're dead, intellectually, mentally, and even morally dead. But you hear the stuff, the rubbish they talk everywhere. I mean, just as an example, it's come immediately to mind. I didn't actually pen some thoughts about this. Perhaps I should have done. The CNN, the young CNN reporter reporting on President Trump's visit to Mount Rushmore, where the monuments to four American presidents are, she described the two of the presidents as owners of slaves and Mount Rushmore as a place stolen from what she called Native Americans. Now, where does she live?
Yeah.
Where does she live? Does she live somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic? No, she lives somewhere in America. Wherever she lived was once inhabited by what I still call Indians, because that's Bureau of Indian Affairs still exists in America, and it's not an insulting term. But it's called the West Indies, after all. You know, so there's nothing wrong with that term, Indian, even if it's a little bit confusing. But the fact is that she got away with referring to George Washington and Jefferson as two slave owners. No, these are two of the great architects of world freedom. And I said to you before, I'm very pro-American. I'm very very sympathetic and grateful to the Americans for the freedom they have conferred on Western Europe. When Western Europe was not prepared to defend itself, the United States of America did. And the freedoms that Americans talk about are the freedoms that essentially given to them by men like Jefferson and Washington. And Teddy Roosevelt was another one of the statues. And Teddy Roosevelt was one of the great Americans of the 20th century. So she just reduces these people to caricatures. And that's the level of discourse you can expect from that generation she has the misfortune to belong to.
And you'd rather, wouldn't you? You'd rather, I might disagree with some of that, it doesn't matter, but you'd rather that you would be taken on in the manner, I mean, we touched on this in the very first chat we had, when you'd be a regular panel guest late on in the Late Late Show, when time would be given to a subject and you'd have a panel of people with varying opinions on it, rather than engage you about US history, good, bad or indifferent. They don't want to do that. They want to just get rid of you. They don't fancy it. They're not up for it. I mean, I'm up for it. You know, I like talking to people. I consider you to be an intellectual. You're a very smart guy. I don't place myself on the same level as you. You know, but I'm up for it. I'm up to disagree with you from time to time. They don't want to do that. They want to get rid of you. And it was funny, you mentioned in your article in The Spectator, it's very good, it's a really good piece, I recommend people read it. You mentioned that Rowling and her fellow signatories of this letter that seemingly is, you know, trying to raise the alarm about this, in fact, didn't have the courage of their convictions, didn't want to get into Black Lives Matter and some of these other issues either, which is a bit strange.
Yeah, well, then the shocking thing about that letter was they denounced President Trump. Now, it's hard to like President Trump, but he has actually many qualities, many good qualities. He has almost as many, or perhaps more, bad qualities. He's a very complex person. But you can't look at America and say, well, the only person we're going to denounce now is President Trump, and not the people who are destroying, pulling down the statues, not the men who, or women, who murdered the black policeman in St. Louis. And the chief of police in St. Louis said that this man, David DeVore, I think his name was the murdered police officer who was minding a pawnbroker shop and for a friend. And the chief of police said, you know, this man mentored us. Now, the chief of police was a black man, and the man who was murdered was a black man. So, you know, Black Lives Matter means Black Lives Matter. It means all Black Lives Matter, and that means the lives of police officers matter, as do the lives of white people. We cannot go back to apartheid days and differentiate people between people because of their races. That's barbaric. It's a kind of quasi-fascist stuff. Nobody actually who's civilized thinks that a black life is more or less important than a white life, but that's exactly what Black Lives Matter is about. And so many of the media have bought into this, these fictions. The headline in the Irish Times a couple of weeks ago was "White Lives Banner Mars Manchester City Victory."
Right, I thought, yeah.
Now, why would a banner saying "White Lives Matter" mar a victory, whereas a "Black Lives Matter" banner wouldn't?
Yeah.
Why? What is this? And this is a very serious issue. This is a very serious issue. It is the greatest issue of our time, where you are allowed to create barriers between the races and invent partitions which don't actually exist, and therefore based a morality which differentiates between the owner or participant or a being of one race and treat that person differently from another race. We all know where this leads. It leads to dictatorship. And one of the problems that I have about what's happening in this world is we just do not know the longer-term outcome. Just to go back to the Holocaust, when Hitler came to power on January the 30th, 1933, nobody had the least idea that within 10 years, most of the Jewish population of Europe would be dead. But what Hitler began with was the murdering of the mentally disabled.
Yeah, yeah.
And once he discovered you could do that, that's where the first gassings were done, of the mentally disabled. When he discovered you could get away with that, against the opposition of the Catholic Church and some of the Lutheran churches, but he found he was able to do that. And because there was no serious, coherent resistance to that, he spread the technique and the psychology and the apparatus of murder from the mentally disabled to the Untermenschen, the undermen, the lesser species. And most of those would have been regarded as Jews. Others went as well, as we know, homosexuals and gypsies and so on and so forth. Once you abandon a binding morality within a society, over time you will find those who rule you are more than happy to see that morality go, because that gives them the moral power to do whatever they like. And by that time, it's too late to prevent them doing whatever they like.
And there's echoes of this, Kevin.
What we're going through now is a very, very dangerous time.
Can I just say this?
Just let me finish that.
Yeah,
what's really shocking is the absence of pushback from the political classes in Britain, in Ireland, and in the United States of America. Sorry, Richard, go on.
No. Listen, I was interrupting only because you're touching a nerve in me. I agree. I see the echoes of... I can't say I see the echoes or I hear the echoes of what happened in Nazi Germany here just yet. But what we've seen since the COVID, since the virus, since the alleged so-called pandemic began, the measures that have been taken by governments to enforce lockdowns on people, but also now today, calls from academics around the country, uniformed right across the UK media, that vaccines in the future should be mandatory. Men, women and children, religious exemptions should go by the wayside and financial penalties should be used to force people to have a vaccination. And for me, yeah, maybe I'm a bit childish, maybe I'm a bit immature. For me, I think the Nazis, you know, take this, it'll be good for you. I don't like it. Do you make any comparison? I mean, I suppose you have been talking about this morality crusade that we're seeing in social media circles. But in terms of everything that's happened around the lockdown, I've got to say, Kevin, I'm not anti-vax. I'm pro-safe medicine. But there are a lot of, you know, red flags at the moment in recent years around certain medicines and vaccines. We know the swine flu vaccine gave people narcolepsy. They're saying today that people are going to have to accept that it'll be the vaccine or it'll be living with some sort of, you know, social distancing and what have you for years to come. That scares the bejesus out of me. What do you think of it?
Well, it should do. Yeah, it should do. States don't surrender power once they've acquired it. And politicians don't surrender power once they've acquired it, unless there's a law compelling them. If they had their way, they would retain power forever. There isn't a single president in the 20th century that I can think of, or even the 21st, in the United States of America, that freely and joyfully walked out of the White House. Every one of them would have done a Roosevelt and stayed on for an extra two sessions if they could. These people are not like us. That's the most important thing your listeners should remember. politicians are not like us. They want power. They want to interfere on people, in people's lives in the way the rest of us don't. I want to hear other people's opinions, but I don't want to, and I want to be able to then to hear me, but I don't want them to obey me. Politicians are not like that. They want to interfere in people's lives, both publicly and privately. And if you feed that addiction, then the addiction grows greater. Now, the problem about, not the problem, it's much worse than the problem. These are conjoined issues, Black Lives Matter and the viral epidemic, pandemic, whatever magic word you use. What they both do is compel obedience. They both compel submission. They both compel people to surrender their individual willpower. Now, to be sure, in a time of war, such as in Britain in 1940, 41, and so on and so forth, there can be no complete freedom. You have to compel people to do things, otherwise, you know, the Nazis will prevail. So I'm not saying that the government should never, ever have some control or a great deal of control over people's lives, but it must be that individual freedom must be surrendered very reluctantly, with a firm undertaking that whatever was surrendered will be returned when the crisis is over. Now, I haven't heard the kind of conversation that this consists of occurring anywhere in America or Britain, or, and certainly not Ireland, where it's an endless congratulation of the government. I mean, that's the most extraordinary thing. There is almost no culture of criticism now in Ireland. The new Catholicism it now prevails, so that whereas once upon a time the Cardinal of Ireland was the kind of ultimate moral authority, now you have the politically correct Archbishops of Ireland having complete authority over almost all discourse, almost all conversation. And there is no dissent. So, and one of the things, the most disagreeable things, has been the endless comparison between Britain and Ireland about how superior the Irish are to the British. This is almost racist, the way the language has been. And we should be actually having, wherever you are, whether you live in Manchester or Oldham or Dewsbury or Portsmouth or Belfast or Galway or wherever, we should be having vigorous conversations about what is going on. I mean, how can we trust our political classes to give us back what we are loaning them? We're not surrendering them. We are loaning our freedoms so they can be returned with interest when the day comes. That's not being heard. No one's saying it. And it's bewildering for me. Maybe it's the age I am. You know, I'm a child pretty much of the 60s and 70s. I grew up in a time of great sexual liberation, sexual experimentation, and we just took things for granted. We took our freedom for granted. But at another level, we who were born after the Second World War knew that an entire generation was prepared to die for that freedom. It was a real debt that we owed that earlier generation. It was real. It was tangible. We carry it with us wherever we go. That's the reason why there are Jews in Manchester and there are Jews in Ireland, because people were prepared to die to prevent the Nazis conquering these islands. Now, those of us of my generation are aware that we have that freedom because a price was paid for it. And I don't think the younger people have any real sense of that. No. They don't. Freedom is not even a tangible thing as it is for me. It's something that they just take for granted, because they take it for granted. They place no value on it. And if you have no value on it, then it'll cost you nothing if someone takes it away. And in fact, it'll cost you everything. Now, we are looking at a crisis is going to go on indefinitely. That the point is, the most important point is that these things have to be looked at with a historical perspective, not how things are to be judged today, but how will they be in 10 years' time? What will the result be of the policies that are now being embraced by governments? And what will the consequences be when the political classes decide, actually, we rather like having these powers, and it's not necessary for you people, you plebs, to have those powers back? And you know, the problem is, now I said that again, is one of the many problems is that the younger generation have no sense of what they're losing, because they never cherished it. If you don't cherish it, you don't value it, well, it's gone, until they open up camps for the disobedient and the inconvenient. And they won't be using the language of the Third Reich, but they'll be using language, you know, that will be more modish and more acceptable and more right on and more politically correct. And within political correctness, there you have all the seeds of totalitarianism. And the strives they have made in the last 30 years. That's the first time I came across the term political correctness in 1989. And the strides that they have made through free and democratic societies have been extraordinary. And they're irreversible. And there are so many things we can't discuss now. And there are so many ways of silencing people by calling them misogynist or racist or xenophobe, or in my case, quite incredibly, anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
When every single Jew in Ireland said, this man is not an anti-Semite. There were no Jews in Ireland said, this man is an anti-Semite. No, they stood up for me. That didn't make any difference. It was Gentiles calling me an anti-Semite in Ireland.
That was the most scary thing for you, wasn't it? That, I mean, because when we first spoke, the fact that Jews came out as strongly as they did around the country, and they, you know, their representative groups, the big representative groups, they said, we've known this man for years. We know what he writes. We like him or we don't like him, but we know that he isn't anti-Semitic. And then, rather than the newspapers and everybody else way back and say, ah, Jesus, we got it wrong, Kevin, didn't. That was horrendous for you, right? That was terrible, that.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually, I mean, apart from the deaths of my parents, it was the worst thing in my life. It has to have been the worst thing and will remain the worst thing, I hope, until, you know, I don't think it's not conceivable while I still have life that anything as bad as that can happen. Well, I shouldn't say that. But it was unspeakable because the untruth took over my world and untruth triumphed and untruth conquered. And the partisans of untruth, the advocates of untruth, they were triumphant too. And they gloated. People who had never said a word about me for a decade, 2 decades, suddenly were gathered around my prone torso and were kicking me howling with joy, yelling untruths, anti-Semite, misogynist. Misogynist, you know, it means, very simply, it means you hate women. You hate a woman because she's a woman, nothing else. That's it. Has no other value. It doesn't mean you're a critic of feminism, which is what I certainly am. But, you know, I've done a word search through the Irish Times. Not one single person accused me in the previous 20 years of being a misogynist. Not one. Not one. I mean, it just never happened. And that week, I became the greatest misogynist in the world.
Yeah. Staggering it was.
So it's available for anyone to use this arsenal of vocabulary. Just utterly destructive. You get a word wrong, Richie.
You're gone, yeah.
And you're dead.
Do you know, I say to my...
If the mob turns on you, you're dead.
I say to my listeners at least once every 3 months, I'm very lucky. I'm self-employed. I do what I do. And I'm on the good grace of my audience. And thank God it works. So I'm okay. I can say things sometimes that people don't like and what have you. And I'm okay. I'm not going to be done for. But I do say to my listeners, do purge. If you work for a private company, you got to purge your Twitter account and your Facebook account, because the day will come when somebody who doesn't like you will dig up something that you said from 2012. And of course, it might look a bit hostile or it might look a little bit nasty on its own. But of course, out of context, anything can. And you could be done for. I tell them all the time. Just on the COVID thing, Kevin, the government of the UK has published its own report that suggests that more than 200,000 people will be killed as a result of the lockdown for various reasons. You saw that, right? And they're saying now that 45,000 people have died of it. But the vast majority of those were inside care homes, and they were immunosuppressed senior citizens. I'm not suggesting that we should abandon them. I'm saying it's not a big deal to anybody else. And yet when Gavin Williamson, the UK Education Secretary, was asked on Sky News today, what will history say? Oh, history will say the lockdown was good. All the evidence is that we've already gotten a herd immunity already in this country, that most of us have probably had the bloody thing and it's gone. And yet they're sticking to it, and they're sticking to the thing that we must accept. No going to the pub without masks, no going to the cinema, wearing masks in shops, all this until we get the vaccine. I don't want to dwell on this, until we get the vaccine, but we're in new territory now. This is brand new, even for a guy, I'm 20 years, 15 years younger than you, Kevin. I never saw this coming, this level of, I'm going to call it what it is, totalitarianism. You know, we're going to restrict your freedoms for a virus that, I've had real doctors on the programme, guys like, luminaries like Vernon Coleman, many others, and they've said, this is madness. Yeah, they can't get on the air.
One of the things that really I detest are these massage triggers.
Yeah.
For example, the Irish Times has been, which is a shocking, it's turned into a shocking newspaper. The Irish Times, which is fully on board for the pandemic agenda, has been carrying a series of articles about the lives we've lost. And one of the lives they lamented, you know, cut short in his prime, was a man who was aged 100 years of age. And another one was, we've lost one of our sporting heroes. Well, yes, we had. He was a sporting hero, played Gaelic football for Laois, that's a county in the centre of Ireland, in the 1950s. Yeah. Now, when you have truth being turned upside down and used as a cudgel to make you believe something that isn't actually true, in this case, that we are all equally at risk from COVID-19, then you know something very sinister is afoot. And we were told big lies before. We were told we were going to get avian flu. We were also told we were going to get AIDS.
Yeah.
And we were all told we were going to get AIDS. And the governments, all governments across Europe made it a point of principle to say that everyone is equally at risk from AIDS when we knew that wasn't the case. We knew that drug addicts and male homosexuals were much more likely to get AIDS than that. But the big untruths succeeded at that time. And the big untruths have succeeded this time. In both empowering the population and in convincing that population that their political leaders know best. So you massage the figures. You create false outcomes to the disease. Somebody who's 95 or 96 on the way out anyway, well, their final symptoms were COVID-19. Therefore, we say that's what he or she died of. Now, it's obviously madness. There's not one of your listeners will say, I really approve of that.
Yeah.
Not one of the listeners will say that. So we are assenting to and consenting to falsehood becoming truth. And you go back to the big T word, the totalitarian word. That's what these people do. Not just the Nazis, not just the fascists, the communists too. And we call these new ones, the new totalitarians. We haven't got a name for them because they're not simply communists. They're not fascists. We haven't got a word for them. But they will convince us that things that they believe and might actually believe, but they will compel us to accept these as abiding dogmas upon which the running of our society must be based. And we don't know the consequence. You have to go 5 years down the road, which it's not a luxury anyone's got. We haven't got the magnifying glass that can see 5 years down the road.
Do you know what
but
the consequence
in
is,
Hitler, Kevin? In 1933, when he came to power, that terrible day in January, didn't know that within 6 years or 7 years or within 6 years, he would be at war with all of Europe. With 7 years, he will have conquered Western Europe. Within 8 years, he will have exterminated millions of Jews. I mean, the first half of the millions. And he would have enabled his Einsatzkommando and Einsatzgruppen to kill by hand 2 million Jews. The first 2 million Jews were not killed in gas chambers. They were killed by hand. And that's not what nobody foresaw that in the world at all, that January day in 1933. So we have to look at that sort of time frame to work out what our political classes are up to, what is this momentum of Black Lives Matter, what is that leading to? It is a vector, that is to say, it's a force with a direction. Now, we don't know what the direction is. We don't know what the intention of Black Lives Matter is, except this. It's anti-family and it's anti-capitalism. Now, those are two good reasons to oppose Black Lives Matter. And it's nothing to do with black lies. We're all agreed, black lies, yellow lies, brown lies, white lies, pink lies, we all count equally. But they're not about that. They're using this bogus slogan to advance an agenda that is quite sinister. And they've beguiled people like Intel and Pepsi-Cola into funding them. So we have a kind of new Bolshevik party. I don't know. Obviously, the term is a little bit imprecise, but it needs to be imprecise because we don't know what these people actually have in mind. They trade on black lives. This is their moral currency. It gives them an elevation which the rest of us haven't got because we think life is actually quite complex and we can't deal in simple trinities like Black Lives Matter, like a freedom, equality, brother. That doesn't tell you anything. Black Lives Matter tells you nothing except these people want power. They want to destroy things. They want to destroy the United States of America. They want to destroy the United Kingdom. They do not want the United Kingdom as it is. They want another kind of polity. But what that actually is, we don't know, because we don't know who their leaders are. We never hear them. They allow the mob to take over, and the mob takes over very successfully. They seem to be able to prime their youngsters to go off and do things and then to hold them back. But we don't know when they're going to go charge again. We don't know what city is going to be the seat of their next insurrection, whether it's going to be in Britain or somewhere in America. I mean, wherever they have held in Seattle, that few hundred square yards, it might be a mile or so, well, they had their first killings there last week. And the chief police of Seattle announced that in that area, killings, violent robberies and rapes have gone up. Who is the chief of police in Seattle? It's a black woman. It's a black woman. So, you know, you can't tell that black woman that black lives matter. She knows what lives matter. All lives matter. And she is the one who has to protect those lives. And she's a proud defender of the American Constitution. That's worth protecting anyway. And worth protecting the memory of Jefferson, who was the primary architect of the American Constitution, and George Washington, of course, who was its enabler. These things are worth cherishing. I mean, were people perfect in the past? Of course not. But if we want to remove a statue, there is a democratic process by which it can be done. That horrible man Colton in Bristol, I think that statue should be taken down. But not by me, not by the mob. The local council, whoever it is, has responsibility for that, financial responsibility and curative responsibility. That's the body that should decide these things. You know, and this madness spreads. You know, in Leicester, which is the place I was born, there's a motion to remove the statue of Gandhi.
I saw that.
I don't know who it is. It's a woman living in Coventry. And she said that Gandhi is a racist, sexist and casteist. That's to say, he defended the Hindu caste system.
Yeah.
Well, I can't think of a greater recipe for bloodshed in Leicester than somebody removing the statue of Gandhi. And why would anyone think that that's an appropriate gesture in a multiracial city with many sensitivities such as Leicester? What they do.
It's what
they
do.
People love conflict.
Let me ask you this final question. We've got exactly 2 minutes. You can have the last 2 minutes. We've been listening to Kevin Myers. He's become a good friend of the programme's, legendary Irish columnist, author and broadcaster. And great to have Kevin back on the show today. What I think is going to happen, right, is, and I can see it happening, because of how people are self-censoring and how people are minding their P's and Q's more than ever when opining on anything. The Chinese have put in place a system which we've come to know as a social credit system, where every individual is assigned a credit score based on their behaviour, their thoughts, the things that they stand up for, the things they don't stand up for, more scarily, and sorts of things like that. And it basically works as a variety of rewards for do-gooders and punishments for those who don't. And the Black Mirror television series, run by Channel 4, an amazing thing, they imagined a dystopian future where we will all have a credit score based on... I wonder, did Kevin Myers stand up and say something nice about gay people today? He didn't, did he not? Well, let's take his score down by 10 points. I'm not joking. I believe that's where we're going if we don't stop.
You're not joking. No,
yeah.
I deliberately don't have... I have a mobile telephone which can make phone calls. I haven't got a smartphone or an iPad or anything like that. I have got a laptop at home. I won't allow myself to have any sort of piece of technology which will tell people what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, where I'm going, etc. I will not allow that to enter my life. Nobody in authority knows very much about me. So the introduction of this new technology at the start of this century has been ungoverned by government.
Yeah.
No democratic authority was conferred on these people to change our lives the way they have done. Changing the way we personally think, the way we act, the way we interact with one another. We've all seen people sitting in a group in a restaurant on their mobile phones, consulting their mobile phones and ignoring their neighbours. It's entirely new behaviour. And when you have that kind of indoctrination to worship the thoughts and the activities of strangers on a handheld device and they ignore the people around you, you know that almost anything can result down the line. And the Chinese experiment is bad enough. Worse is the approval that so many Chinese have given to this notion of personal control. So you will be detected jaywalking. The facial face recognition technology is so advanced in China now that they are able to identify people and in jaywalking, and that they have social credit deducted at the end of the week. That means they can't go to a nightclub, or they can't go to a restaurant, or they can't go to university. I mean, it accumulates so that ultimately you will end up in jail. Now, it's not difficult to understand the consequences of this. It's not difficult to predict where it leads. What is really shocking is the absence of allowed predictions about this. Really shocking that politicians are not saying, well, actually, we're not going to allow this. This is technology which we are not going to permit even to adults, never mind to children. The fact that children, school children, are allowed to have these machines and allow their brains to be developed and shaped, their neurons shaped, their pathways, mental pathways shaped by the Silicon Valley giants of California, is insane. It is actually nothing less than insanity that power has been conferred to these people who are only interested in money. And as we know, and I think that you and I were talking about this before, the big moguls of Silicon Valley do not allow their children to have their phones.
Of course
they
don't.
Know how dangerous these phones are. Yet the ordinary people, the dross, the plebs, the lesser species, the untermenschen, if you like, their children are allowed to have their brains corrupted by these people. They are allowed to have their neuron pathways determined for the rest of their lives by accessing the ideas and the thoughts of social media. It is so obviously wrong.
That's the
it's
thing.
So obviously
That's
dangerous.
Yeah. It's
it is perplexing magic. To me that there isn't an outcry in every parliament in Europe and America.
Do me a favour, Kevin. Do me a favour.
People are not saying stop it.
No, they're not. Come back any time you want. Don't wait to be invited back. I hope I'll be reading you again in The Spectator. I know you've been on News Talk in Dublin. I see a bit of a comeback. Maybe there's a book in the offing about where all this is going, maybe, from
Kevin
Myers.
Well, there's a book in the offing. I've got a memoir coming out, I hope, in September. It's been held back 3 years because of COVID and because of my lawsuit against RTE, which I won, and then neither the Irish Times nor RTE News reported the fact I had won a very large amount of money from RTE for calling me a Holocaust denier. This is a new world we're in. If news people don't like the news that they have to report, they don't report it.
They don't read it. Yeah, they don't read it.
But this is incredible.
Yeah, it's the same
this
with the it's the same with the death numbers over here. All the evidence points to the lockdown being a complete waste of time and money. But that information is shredded and they go with the nonsense from the official Chief Medical Officer of England. Now, when I said you're welcome back anytime, I mean it. Don't wait to be asked. I love having you on, Kevin. It's great.
Well, it's nice to be on, Richie. It's always nice to be on.
Thanks for doing
it. Well, listen, I've got your number in my telephone and it's an old-fashioned telephone. And if I want to vent my anger at the world, I'll give you a shout.
Well, I'll always give you a chance to vent. Thanks very much, Kevin. Love having
you
on.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Great writer, great broadcaster, Kevin Myers. On the Richie Allen Radio Show for Monday. It's coming up for 9 minutes past the hour. Kevin is in Kildare. Check him out. Check out the article in The Spectator and check out his books as well. Top man. Right, we've got to take headlines. Well, we don't have to do anything we don't want to do, really, but we're going to take headlines. And when we come back from that, Zed Phoenix should be standing by. I look forward to speaking with him, taking the government to court, speaking of masks and lockdowns. Zed Phoenix joins us. First of all, headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Researchers at Oxford University in the UK say they've made big progress developing a possible vaccine against COVID-19. Britain is suspending its extradition treaty with Hong Kong following China's imposition of a new security law in the city. And the United Arab Emirates has launched the Hope Orbiter on a 7-month journey to Mars to study the planet's weather.
Yeah.
China and the US are preparing similar launches.
The weather on Mars, eh? Yes, indeed. Lots coming up on the programme this week. I'll tell you more about that later on if there's any time. You can follow this programme, of course. I know you know this. It's on Twitter, it's at Richie Allen Show. There is a Facebook page, look for The Richie Allen Show on Facebook. And it's richieallen.co.uk, that's my website, richieallen.co.uk. The BBG, not the BBC. Monday, beautiful evening in Salford here in the northwest of the UK. Beautiful. Here's Natalie Imbruglia, song's called Torn, love this song. Right, let's 86, Natalie Imbruglia, 12 minutes past the hour. 12 minutes past six it is, of course, here in the city of Salford. My Before we introduce or reintroduce my next guest, let me tell you that while, if you were listening to the monologue earlier on, a lot of discussion today about mandating vaccines. Lot of discussion about mandating vaccines. Professors of philosophy from Oxford University doing the rounds of the media today, explaining how it could be mandated, how coercion could be introduced to people. We'll stop your payments. We'll stop child support. We will prevent your child going to school. We will do this, we will do that, unless you take the vaccine. And one of the things we know that is for sure coming down the line is the what some people have called the health passport. Some people call it the health freedom passport. It's basically a passport that every one of us would have. It's technology that is already in existence. There's a big company in Manchester involved in producing these health passports. These are applications that would live on your smartphones, your smartwatches. These days, if you watch television, you see a lot of these adverts in the middle of TV programs. And basically, these digital passports would be updated with your information, including whether or not you have been inoculated. And we were told in great detail about these passports by my guest today, who is challenging the government's plans to introduce these health passports and wants to take them to court and is fundraising to do so. He's an investigative journalist, a broadcaster and author, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back. Let's say hello again to Zed Phoenix. Zed, you're very welcome back. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you, Richie. How are you?
I'm good, mate. Thanks. And we'll talk in great depth now in a minute about your crowdfunding to take the government to court to challenge this legally, which is fascinating, of course. But I also want to talk about, because it is genuine and serious, the sorts of interference that you find, that you encounter when you do the sorts of things that you're doing. And you're coming up against it quite a lot lately. I'm talking about censorship and videos disappearing and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what you've got to understand is that for the government, the health passport or immunity passport or freedom passport, as you rightly called it, is one of the sort of primary things they're doing as part of this COVID-19 pandemic, what they want to get out of it. They've always wanted it. They've wanted a digital passport for years. And so this is the way they're going to do it. And of course, so we're challenging that. And the way we're going to challenge it is by taking them to court and having a judge, basically, or a group of judges, look at our evidence, look at what they're trying to do as far as surveillance and collecting our data and sending it off to other companies and, you know, sort of confining you to your homes and all that kind of stuff, using your smart device. That could be your smartphone, your smart tablet or watch, as you said. And so when you do these things, you come up with massive resistance. And on Wednesday, my Facebook page was taken down, which meant we essentially our campaign was severely halted for a day, let's say, because essentially all our sort of followers couldn't then sort of get the link and share it and go to the crowdfunding site. So this is the sort of things they do. My Apple iPhone was disabled. Now I've taken it to the shop and the guy in the shop says, well, this is what happens when something gets stolen. So they put a code out and it's disabled it. My Gmail account has disappeared. I had all my emails, thousands of them. They've all gone. So this is the kind of things that they do. I've experienced it before, so this isn't my first rodeo, as it were. But it's just it still surprises me at the level of which they'll go to try and stop reasonable people from asking reasonable questions.
No doubt. Now, forgive me for asking this, but I'll ask it anyway. Are you jumping the gun with respect to the legal action? Because as far as I know, now I know you'll correct me if I am wrong, but I haven't seen or heard anything official from NHS England or from our government to say we will require people in 2021 to possess a digital passport, a health passport. So I understand what everything you said to me, and it's right and proper, but is the legal action, is it a bit preemptive, is it a bit early, or am I on the wrong track here?
No, you're not on the wrong track. And yes, it is early because, you know, as we sort of found out with Simon Dolan's case, yeah, when something comes in and then you complain about it, it's actually too late, because then all the government's got to say is essentially, which is what they did effectively with his case, is that we saved more lives than we would have ordinarily if we hadn't have done lockdown. So with this, what we've decided to do is Matt Hancock started this back in March, and he said we could have health passports in within a couple of months.
Yeah.
So that was in March. And then last week he turned around, and because if you remember, there was a story about three migrants who had been working on a farm. They had run away. They had disappeared. One had COVID-19. They'd all tested positive. And so Matt Hancock then came back out and said, we want migrants having the health passport as they come in. So it's going to start off with migrants, and then it's going to be rolled out to the rest of us. So what we want to do by taking this to court is catch this before they bring it out to the public and make them stop and think. And so what we've done is we've compiled a whole bunch of evidence, which is about surveillance, which is about all the things that we have in our society already, and then how the health passport sits on top of all that, bringing all this surveillance in. And for one reason only, which is to sort of track you and to control you through your smart device and stuff. So it's not that we're jumping the gun. It's that we are sort of on the money, as it were, as far as bringing the action to the government. We just want to do it before they bring it in, rather than waiting for them to bring it in and then challenging them, because I think then it would be too late.
You're right to mention the things that Hancock has said. He certainly has broached it as a subject more than once, and certainly with reference to the migrants who went missing. No policy document yet, though. What is interesting is there a precedent? Has anybody done this before? Has anybody preempted a government in the past and thought, they're just about to bring something in, it's terrible, I'm going to put a roadblock in the way, I'm going to take legal advice on that? Have you come across any precedent?
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. I mean, the thing is that, you know, when we talk to our barristers and we talk to our legal teams, and I've talked to a lot of barristers about this, not just the ones that are our team, this is something that does happen. All the government has to do is mention something for you to then to say, well, do we agree or do we disagree? Now, under these circumstances, it is unusual, it is different, but we haven't been in this situation before. So why watch Simon Dolan's case very, very carefully? And I read his court documents with great interest. And I just realised, as he was going through his case, that it was all just a bit sort of too late, as it were, you know. And I think that really affected the judgment. On Wednesday, we had a court ruling in the European Union. It wasn't us, it was another group that did this in Europe. And basically what they had said was pretty much similar to us. It was about surveillance and about civil liberties and about democracy and about how your data is shipped off to America and other countries. So when you go on the internet, if you're on Facebook, Facebook is based in America, all your data goes off to America. And the same with Google and YouTube, which is owned by Google and et cetera. So this was about stopping American surveillance, essentially, on Europeans. And the judgment came out on the side of the people, saying, yes, people need to be able to know if they're being surveilled, because, of course, you'd want to take court action. Now, you can't take court action if you're being surveilled unless you know about it. You know, when MI5 do operations and the police do operations, you get to find out and then you can take court action at some point. It may be after the fact, of course, it's never during. So this is something that we're doing. This is something that has been done before with other cases. It is possible to do this. And it's just really to make the government stop and think, and for people to have their say. And this is the only mechanism that we have at our disposal. And it's extremely expensive. It really is. I mean, it's very difficult to do these things just on a monetary basis, yeah, which is how they basically stop you, isn't it? And so we're having to raise the money independently to do this. It's not a long shot by any stretch of the imagination. Every barrister that I've talked to who has been allowed to talk to me about this subject is rightly concerned about what's going on and how surveillance and data collection is affecting our lives, and obviously with the health passport scheme. Now, the health passports with VST Enterprises, it's just sitting there. It's been sitting there since before March. And
ready
just
to go.
Learnt.
Ready to go, right?
Yeah, it's ready to go. Mm. And I learned before about a year and a half ago, they were working on it. Now, we're going to try and bring that into our court case. The European ruling, we're going to add that to our court case as well to strengthen it, say, hey, look, this is what the judges in Europe have said. And hopefully what the judgment will kind of come out on the side of. It's not a right or wrong thing. And we've got to be clear about that. There is going to be a judgment. In other words, they're going to sit there and they're going to have a think about this and they're going to say, right, is the government going to do this? This is what our letter before action is going to be to Matt Hancock. So we'll write a letter to Matt Hancock, to their legal department, and we'll say, this is what we think you're doing. And we basically want to have a discussion about the health passports before you bring them in. And then once that's in the public domain, then it allows the press and the media and everyone else, all of us, to start discussing it then and puts it on the table. And I think the more people know about it, the less they'll want it, quite frankly.
Very. And you've raised, to date, you've raised over £20,000, which is really impressive. I know it's going to be more expensive further down the line. And we will, you can tell me the link in a moment where people can make a contribution if they're in a position to do that. But before that, the thought always occurs to me, these legal expenses are horrifyingly large. Where are the morally inclined barristers, men and women of the legal profession in the UK? This is a huge human rights issue. There should be barristers in this country prepared to do it for free.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we've gone to them. I mean, the world that we live in is, as far as this goes, is very small. There are a lot of sort of legal services are about family courts and whatnot and immigration issues and stuff. So surveillance and health passports and all that kind of stuff and data collection, it's by a few people. Now, what we found interesting is that pretty much every person that we went to who was a human rights advocate had already received a retainer. They couldn't tell us who from. One company put it on their website, and it was from George Soros of £10 million.
Wow.
So they
say that again. Say that again about Soros. Repeat
okay,
that.
So George Soros has been at least on one count. One major law firm had given them a £10 million retainer, and so they turned round to me and said, "We have a conflict of interest." And I said, "How so?" And they couldn't go into it. They just said, basically, it's on our website. Read the website. So I read that George Soros was involved with them. And of course, he's one of the advocates of the health passport system, and along with Bill Gates and with his digital ID and the rest of the cabal, as we call them.
The capo regimes. They're Don Corleone's capo regimes, aren't they? These guys, Soros and Gates. And I mean, you've put the pieces of the jigsaw together quite... remarkably, really, in recent months, about Gates's links to academia here and also to politics here. It's staggering. So we might come back to that in a minute. But I suppose that's what they do. I mean, they would have learned that. That's an old trick, that, isn't it? Any wealthy man or wealthy woman who wants to divorce his or her husband or wife, they often pollute the lawyer pool, don't they, by phoning lawyers, just have a discussion with them. So that is really, really interesting. Zed Phoenix is our guest. We're talking about his his coming legal challenge, his letter before action that has been sent or will be sent to the Health Secretary, because he believes, does Zed, that this government is going to introduce a mandatory health passport for everybody, a digital thing. And just remind our listeners, Zed, who might be brand new to this, this would exist on your phone or your watch or your tablet, but most likely it would exist on your phone. Your thing would be turned on, your location would be turned on, your Bluetooth would be turned on, and it would be on your phone, and it would have information on there about you, that if you and me decided we'd go to Stringfellow's nightclub tomorrow night, me and you, for a few drinks, there might be a reader on the door there in the near future, which might say, let Zed in, but don't let the Irish guy in, because he's not had the vaccine. Am I oversimplifying that? But it's along those lines, right?
No, that's exactly how it works. So if you go to a supermarket, before you go in, they want to know you're healthy. If you go to a B&B and check in, they'll want to know that you're healthy, that you've had the vaccine. And as we've learned today, they are, again, talking about sort of mandating vaccines.
Yeah.
Now, with the health passport system, what we found out is that in actual fact, they don't actually need to make vaccines mandatory, because essentially if you can't get in and if you can't access services because you haven't had the vaccine, so your phone says, comes up with a little red blob and says, no, you can't have access until you've seen a health professional. That's essentially mandating vaccines through the back door or any kind of medical therapeutics or medical treatments. So, for example, if I don't have the vaccine, they might say to me, well, you're having a mental health issue. And so you need to see a health professional. And that's what this is all about, really. I mean, it's very simple. There's a number of adverts on at the moment. I think there's a drinks one and there's a couple of others that has the traffic light system. So I think, you know, one of these kind of, I can't remember what the drink was, but the kind of the drink sort of wanders up to the amusement park and it bleeps him and it goes red because it's got artificial colours in. The other one comes up and it goes green because he's full of sort of goodness, you know what I mean? So they're kind of acclimatizing people through commercials, through adverts, to the health passport and how it will work, you know, subliminally.
Yeah, and I asked you before, I'll ask you again, do you ever think you'd be here talking about this? I mean, I didn't, and I've kept the company of many men and women who've written books and given talks around the world, many of them very sincere people, one or two of them dodgy, but generally well-meaning. And despite the dire warnings and the predictions, I didn't think we'd be here this quickly anyway. I really didn't. What about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, sadly, I knew this was coming. I didn't know what exactly was coming. Yeah. I knew it was coming in 2020 because that's what everyone was geared up for. I mean, when I used to be in the media, they used to talk about this time, you know, when everyone would be in their houses and stuff. And we'd laugh about it. We didn't, you know, no one really believed it and stuff. So, yes, I did know this was coming. I didn't know what it would look like. I didn't know that it would be a health epidemic and they'd use a virus. But it's very clever to do so because it scares people. It's the only thing that probably does work because essentially, you know, if you think about it, there's very few things in the world that actually do scare people, you know, scares everyone on the same level so you can control the whole planet, essentially. So, you know, I'm very sort of, I mean, I'd retired, Richie, really. I'd left all this behind, you know. I'd won my court case. I was out, you know, and I was glad to be out. And yet when I started looking into this stuff, I thought, you know what? This is bigger than me. This is bigger than us. You know, we've got to come out with this information. If it's helpful to people to do that, then I'll do it. And of course, here we are, you know, and, you know, it goes on, doesn't it? So, you know, we're getting the mandatory vaccinations put back on the table when we've already had judges tell us that they don't have enough legislation to do that now. So what are they doing? They're going to have to go and get more legislation to do that, or they'll do it through the health passport. You know, this may be something that creeps in over time, but it is definitely coming. There is no doubt about it. It was mentioned on the Gavi Alliance fundraiser, and they were talking about health passports only very briefly. It's only ever mentioned very briefly. Matt Hancock's mentioned it very briefly. It just gets mentioned again and again and again. It's very sort of under the wire, really, unless you know what you're looking out for, which of course we do, and so this is really disturbing, and this is the control of every man, woman, and child in the country. Our democracy has gone, and we have entered into some dictatorship, and it's going to be a medical dictatorship by the looks of it, which is what Aldous Huxley was warning us about many years ago.
Brave New World is the book for those who haven't read it. Let me ask you this. You'll understand me asking it. I have no choice but to ask it. What about those who will say, brilliant, and you're obviously sincere, you're obviously well-meaning, but how could you not believe that there'd be some pressure brought to bear on any justice, any judge who's given, you know, basically given the brief, given the decision over you and your action? And I know it's not nice to hear that. What you want to hear is encouragement, and I am encouraging you. I think it's a good idea. But at the same time, our listeners will say, very smart guy, that said, but he's got to be a bit naive. Does he trust the judiciary?
No, not really. But what I have realised is that when I was taken to court back in 2015, I was looking at a prison sentence. And I worked out how the court system worked. I understood about judges, I understood about clerks of the court having all the power and everything. I learned as much as I possibly could about that. And I won my case, right? So the odds were stacked against me. There was 20 odd witnesses to me essentially. I had one opportunity to talk for about 20 minutes, and that was it. We'd sat there for 2 weeks. So I was going to prison as far as my barristers were concerned, the solicitors were concerned, everybody, my family thought I was going to prison. And the fact is that I stood there and I told my story very plainly and very simply, and the jury came back on our side. So we could say, well, it's a corrupt system. And I say, well, yes, it quite possibly is, and in more ways than one. But the people that work in it are often good people. If you present a reasonable argument, a good case, which is what we're doing, then, you know, what we're saying is basically, if you're going to have a health passport, then surely it needs to be an opt-in situation, and things like that. So we're presenting a good case. And I believe when the judiciary look at it, they are not going to turn round and say, oh, actually, you know, this is great for public health. There are no data collection issues. There are no surveillance issues. And the government's free to bring it in. I don't believe they'll be saying that, because what I believe they'll be saying is actually there needs to be judicial process over the health passports if and when they are brought in. There needs to be parliamentary oversight over the health passports, which is something that they're not considering or it's not happening. This needs to be discussed in public. It needs to be voted on in public by our parliamentarians. And there needs to be a legal framework because people are going to get abused. And people can be taken advantage of through this. You know, essentially, I could be put onto a permanent lockdown simply by talking out. And they said, well, you've got a mental health issue, so we'll put him on a permanent lockdown until he sees his health professional and starts treatment of some kind. So the abuse is there. And I don't believe any judges in there, any right-thinking judges anyway, will side totally with the government. And I think we'll get a judgment that favours civil liberties, democracy, and the people. And I really do believe that. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it otherwise.
No.
Couple of things. The vaccine thing, and you mentioned a couple of times there, people being sent to be evaluated, maybe sectioned, as we call it here. I think you're onto something there. I noticed in the last few years that the broadcast media and the print media have adopted... Well, they've adopted a kind of a new modus operandi in terms of sending missives around, sending letters around or emails around to their department heads, to editorial heads, saying, don't look for balance on this issue and that issue anymore. The science is settled. We see this with climate change most famously. BBC editors, one particular BBC editor anonymously sent me the first email that went around telling BBC staff not to give any climate change critic or skeptic, no matter how, you know, well educated they may be, don't give them any time. And there's been another issue which doesn't come to the mind as easy. There's one other issue along those lines. Vaccines is the next one for me. It's the one that they're going to determine, again, editors and station managers are going to say, listen, vaccines, they work, they're important, they're a vital, they're a vital tool in terms of protecting the public and health and all of that. And I do foresee a time. I interviewed a lady. It was a staggering bit of radio, really. I've never encountered anything like it. A couple of years ago, there was a lovely lady called Suzanne, who I'm still in touch with, was sectioned because she had an argument with her GP about vaccines and vaccine efficacy. And she was able to ring me from live from the basically the psychiatric hospital where they placed her. And eventually, after a few days, they left her go home because they realised there was nothing wrong with her. But because she annoyed her doctor enough by saying to her doctor, you know, I don't think this is right or that's right, the doctor recommended that she be sectioned and you've no choice. They came along to her house and they asked her to get in a car and they took her away. And I do see that coming down the line. They're really going after it now, this mandating of vaccines, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we're living in a new era. And the era that we're living in is one of the experts, expert scientists, expert health professionals. And they are going to be telling you how to live your life. If you watch mainstream media, that's already happening. You're getting people on the BBC. You're getting people on all the channels that are telling you how to wash your hands, how to live a healthier life style and all this kind of stuff. So we're living in a new era of experts, and this is what's happening. I mean, you know, I haven't made this up. I mean, this has come from VST Enterprises based in Manchester and on Fido, that company who are doing the what they call the immunity passport, which is exactly the same thing. It works in exactly the same way. And they're talking about, you know, you will see your health professional. So if your health passport turns orange, that must mean you need to go and see your doctor. or your health professional for whatever reason, you know, and that might mean a vaccine, that might mean a therapeutic, that might mean a chat of some kind to see how your mental health is.
Yeah.
But this is how we're going to be living now. This is what's going to be controlling
us. What you're describing is sick. I'm walking down the road and I get a ping on my phone and the phone tells me, and I have to believe it, it tells me that I was on a tram from Eccles into Manchester City Centre and I bumped into somebody. And you might be contagious, Richie. There might be something wrong. You need to come in now. That's exactly
that's right.
It. This is sick. I mean,
yeah, this is it.
It's fuck. I'm sorry for swearing. It is sick, this.
And
but you know, can I just ask you this? Have you been heartened by some of the big demonstrations that seem to be getting bigger in London and in other parts of the country where people are saying, no, I've had enough now. And they're coming out against it. I know raves are worrying. People are getting very worried about raves in places like Bristol. And I'm saying to people, don't be worried about raves. These are young men and women. I'm 45 and early middle aged. These are young men and women who would normally go to a nightclub. Their lives have been basically, you know, turned upside down. They've been imprisoned in their homes. I like the fact that they're having their own raves, even if they do keep you up at, you know, 5-6 o'clock in the morning, just one night a week. But yeah, there seems to be quite a bit of gathering civil disobedience. Do you see that as well, and are you heartened by it?
Well, I do see that, and yes, I am heartened by it, because essentially, because we don't speak to each other very often, it's difficult to gauge what the rest of the country is doing. I know what my friends think, yeah. I know what people around me think, but we don't know what people up north or, you know, in London think. And so to see this, really, to me, is a great, you know, it was great to see the beaches packed, you know, full of people and stuff like that, you know. However, with every rave they're going to do, they're going to come out and they're going to say, those are the selfish people, those are the people that are putting you in danger. And quite frankly, they have scared people, the media has scared people witless to accept pretty much anything that comes down the line. So I'm glad that people are going out. I mean, I didn't break the lockdown rules. I followed the guidance. And I stayed in for 3 months. You know, me and my partner, we went shopping alternately and all that kind of stuff. Mainly she did it, to be fair, and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I wasn't someone who was going to, you know, because we didn't really know what we were dealing with to begin with. So I haven't broken the rules or anything like that. But it is good to see that people are being civil, you know, displaying civil disobedience and stuff like that. It's important. We need to do that now more than ever. And you know what? Isn't it funny that revolution doesn't come in the form of guns or battleships anymore? It comes in the form of a rave. And I love that.
I love it as well. Yeah. I mean, I did feel sorry for one of the women who rang Radio 5 Live. I felt, I mean, I would be the first to be kicking and screaming if, I don't sleep very well anyway, but even if I, you know, even if I do get a couple of hours, to be awoken by the bang, 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 bang of dance music, yeah, I would be pretty pissed off. However, in this climate, I might be inclined to be looking for earplugs and saying, go ahead, kids, you know what I mean? Go and do it, because don't take this nonsense.
Yeah.
We criticise younger folks maybe far too often for being more subservient maybe than we are, but evidence is emerging that that isn't the case. Zed Phoenix is our guest, broadcaster, a journalist, and he is leading the action against the UK government's plans to introduce health passports for everybody. This is very important. Now, it's done remarkably well thus far, it really has. You can find Zed on YouTube. I do recommend you subscribe to his channel, and I do recommend, if you haven't watched any of his videos, you watch them now. And they're all there, really, really good stuff, really well put together about how this is basically coming about now, how Gates has infiltrated academia and the politics here in this country and other countries as well. So much to this. Zed Phoenix on YouTube. You will need more financial support going forward. Where do people go to find it? Give it a big plug now.
Okay, so yeah, we're going to need massive support going forward. At the moment, I'm concentrating on the lesser before action, obviously. So if you go to Crowd Justice, and it's join the legal challenge to the UK government on health passports. That's what you're looking for. I do have a link on my YouTube channel. I did put the links out on my Facebook channel, but my Facebook page got taken down on Wednesday. It is out on Twitter. So if you go to @ZedPhoenix, you can find the links there. And I will be putting them up again after the show today. But go to Crowd Justice. It's join the legal challenge to the UK government on health passports, and, you know, donate, join the campaign. I think this is going to be one of the most interesting things that we've ever done. And you know what? We're going to prove to ourselves and to everybody else what they are doing and what's going on, because it's important. People simply do not know and do not understand the implications and how serious these health passports are. And if we can simply get that information into the public domain, win, lose or draw, and it doesn't matter that it's a corrupt system. I understand what people are saying. I understand that completely. There are good people who work in it, and we just need a judgment to come on our side to civil liberties, to human rights, which we do have. We have inalienable human rights, and to protect our democracy. Our democracy is being given away to Google, to Apple. We've had the COVID-19 health passport update. Now, that was an upgrade of everybody's phone's operating system. You can't take it off. It's on your operating system. It's already happened. And this is something different from the Bluetooth that they're doing for the track and trace. And so if you go into your settings, or in, maybe it's in privacy, you can see that you've got the COVID-19 health app. The health architecture for the application is already there. And what I mean by that is that if you travel to America, your health passport has got to then click over to the American health passport or the Australian health passport, very much like your network changes over when you travel to different countries. You suddenly are on a Spanish network or an Indian network. So this is the architecture that they have already put in, and it is different from the Bluetooth applications that they're using for track and trace.
Give us that website again, Zed, please.
Yeah, so it's go to www.crowdjustice.com. And it's case to join the legal challenge against the UK government on health passports by Zed Phoenix.
Will you come back and keep us updated as it progresses? You will.
Yeah, I will. And of course, you know, on that website as well, you know, where we're raising the money, we're going to put up our letters that we're sending. We're going to get the replies. They will go up on there as well. And of course, I'll come back on and I'll tell you how it's going. I'm just hoping that we get to the first stage of doing this, and then from then on, I think once we get the response, people will suddenly start seeing how important this is. So you know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I have a lot of faith in people. We're doing really well so far. It's only been up a week and we're almost done. So yeah, that's amazing. And if everyone can donate, it doesn't come to me, it goes straight to the legal team, so there's no issues over money or anything like that. And I actually really like that. I really appreciate the fact that Crowd Justice
that's really important that because in the independent media in recent years, one or two well-known folks have crowdfunded money from people to basically line their own pockets. And I know you know who I'm referring to, and it's disgusting. And I can echo what Zed just said there, regardless of what I think about Zed's, and I'm hoping he does very well with it, and I'm wishing him all the best with it. But if you put my opinion to one side, I can tell you that he's telling you the truth. The money doesn't go to him, it goes to the legal team, and you can't beat a bit of transparency. You can't beat a bit of it. It's great, Zed. I really wish you the very best with it. These are the times now, and it's difficult to tell people, look, this is what they want. They want us to be going around with a digital passport on our phones, and it's hard because people don't want to hear it. And I want to shake people and say, what will you do next year or in 2022 if it's widespread? What will you do? Will you come back and apologise to me? Will you say, I'm sorry, you weren't crazy? Because it'll be too late then. You've got to make an effort. You've got to try and do something about it and raise the alarm. And you're doing that. So I wish you the very, very best with it, Zed. Nothing more than the best.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, really, because you know what? You know, try as we might, if we don't do it, someone will do it at some point, because it will get so horrific that the cases will mount up. So even though, you know, even if we don't manage to pull this off this time, that's okay, because you know what? At some point, this is going to be in. And it will be in. They're talking about it. They're planning it. It's just sitting there on all these websites. You know, MasterCard have got their wellness pass for MasterCard, which is the health passports, the same thing. We've just given, or the country's just given £25 million to that to help that go on and stuff like that. So then what they're doing is they're getting all the foundations. They're getting everything there. They're bringing up the terror and bringing up the fear. And people will just be like, I just want to go on holiday. I just want to go to the shops. I just want to live my life. And they'll say, you can do it if you have a vaccine. as we've heard today, and if you have a health passport, and you'll be back to normal. Well, that's not back to normal. That's under some weird dictatorship. And quite frankly, I'm not tolerating it for one second, and I don't suspect anyone else should either. We live in a democracy. We have freedoms. We have human rights. We have civil liberties. And I'm not going to allow them to go without a fight, and I'm prepared to put that fight up. And so whatever comes my way, I'm prepared to accept those consequences.
Good man, Zed. Appreciate your time again today. Thanks very much. Godspeed to you. And
you.
We look forward to you coming back and updating us in the very near future. Cheers, Zed. Zed Phoenix, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show for Tuesday, the 20th of July 2020. Thanks to Zed Phoenix. We'll take a tune. And when we come back from that, I'll read one or two of your tweets. And it's flown by this programme, hasn't it? This is Desiree, by the way. Love this tune. From Desiree on your Richie Allen Radio Show. The time is exactly 10 minutes to 6 o'clock. It is Monday's programme. It is the BBG, not the BBC. I think you know that, though. Hi to Hyder. How you doing, Hyder? He says, Richie, why doesn't everyone at the BBC get vaccinated first, along with their families? And let's wait 5 years then, says Hyder, to see what happens, shall we? That's an excellent comment there. Indeed, why don't they take their own medicine? And it is their own medicine, because the BBC is pushing it harder than any other news organisation. That includes Sky News. It's really pushing it hard, you know, the vaccine. And you've got presenters now doing an extraordinary thing. And a neighbour of mine said to me the other day, and I was quite happy to hear this, because I often fear that when I talk about how the media operates, it occurs to me that it can get a bit monotonous and it can get a bit samey, a little bit on the boring side. And I obviously need to be very careful about that. But a neighbour of mine said the other day, it's good, he said, when you highlight what the media is doing and how the presenters behave, the things they say, the words they choose. But you have this remarkable situation now where presenters are giving the answers to their guests rather than asking them any questions. Like, you will see a tin pot presenter suggesting to a government minister or an opposition party shadow minister or even an academic, you will see the presenter saying things like, and of course things won't get entirely back to normal until we get a vaccine, so they won't. Right, why did you do the interview to begin with? Why did you even invite the guest on to begin with, if you're going to tell us and the guest the way it's going to be? And it's blatant now. Even today with Jeremy Vine on BBC Radio 2, very popular early afternoon talk show, where the guy is saying we should mandate vaccines. And Jeremy Vine helpfully suggests ways that could be accomplished. Vine is not saying on behalf of his audience, which is his sole duty and his sole responsibility, to hold the guy's feet to the fire and say, that's outrageous, that you would tell a human being that you have domain over their body and the bodies of their children, that you would say, we're telling you that you have to have the vaccine. Okay, we won't send two goons around in a car to take you away to a vaccination centre, but we'll make life unbearable for you to the point where you'll just give in and you'll roll your sleeve up and say, yeah, go ahead then. I can't take much more of this. Vine would know, and Kay Burley would know, and Adam Bolton would know, and Simon McCoy would know, Robert Peston, Laura Koonsberg, they would know that very, very, very credible, equally credible, when I say equally, men and women whom have the same qualifications as the people who are advising Boris Johnson. The aforementioned journalists know that very credible scientific men and women are out there saying there's no need to carry on with the lockdown. The vaccine probably won't work. because it'll mutate anyway. And, more importantly, herd immunity has been achieved in the UK. Of course it has. Because the only people who died of this thing are, whatever it happens to be, and I still don't know what it is, are very, very senior folks, God love them, whom were trapped in care homes, locked in while elderly folks were taken out of hospitals to free up beds, not checked for any virus, and sent in. Vast majority of people, over 70. Everybody else, either the vast majority again, having no symptoms. A tiny, tiny group of people had some symptoms. And then people like me, if I had it, I got a nasty, nasty respiratory infection in the very early part of this year. So these presenters know this stuff. But rather than calling it out, they do the jobs of their political guests and their scientific guests for them by not asking questions, but by making statements to them. That's the thing to me. It's hard for me to, I said this last week, to watch this, to see a presenter saying, and of course it won't get back to normal till the vaccine, right? Right. And the guest, of course, gleefully responds in the affirmative. Yeah, that's how it works. We're not getting back to normal until, well, 3/4 of the population at least accepts the vaccine. But again, if you came late to the programme today and you missed the monologue and the news roundup, the word is, according to several surveys, at least 27% of people who have been asked, will you voluntarily take a vaccine? In this country, over 1 in 4 people have said no. Hence the doubling down today of academics coming on telly and radio to say we should mandate it. Hi to Rick Kerr. How you doing, Rick? Rick has enjoyed the shows today. And at Does Be Me says to me, Richie, are you the reason Dr. Marcus de Bruin was banned by Twitter? The control of information makes history. And it seems Marcus has upset COVID-19 narrative spewed and promoted not only by the mainstream, but by those in charge of Twitter as well. I only learned this morning that Marcus de Bruin has been on this programme a couple of times as a doctor in Rush in Dublin, has basically disappeared off Twitter. I haven't emailed Marcus yet to ask him what's going on, but I will do that. It wouldn't surprise me, and it won't surprise Marcus de Bruin either. You know, this is where we are. Hi to Aaron Phelan. This is the beginning, you know. Joe Public tweets, how is it possible to create a vaccine or even a test for a virus that has never even been isolated? That's another very good question. I haven't a clue. As far as raves go, Ewan Cooper tweets, Richie, I wouldn't be putting in earplugs. I'd be joining the raves. I'm 45 years old. I'm bald and I'm a gammon. For me, I'll stay up till Christmas if it's music I like, but I've never been a massive fan of electronic dance music, particularly trance. I don't have a lot of time for trance. John Gibbons, who's an old friend whom I met in London at TPV, he does the Alchemy podcast, which is a brilliant podcast. I recommend you check it out, Alchemy. John's a very, very successful international DJ and brilliant by all accounts, but I'm not the biggest fan of trance music, so raves are not for me. But give me a bit of rock and I'll stay up till Christmas listening to it, and I'll never go to bed. Closing out the programme today with James Brown. Why not, eh? We'll speak again tomorrow at 5 o'clock. This has been Monday's programme. Thanks to Zed Phoenix. Good luck to him. And thanks again to Kevin Myers. Lovely to have Kevin on from the old country. Wow, I feel good.